to BMCC's Asian Heritage Month celebration. We're honored to have everyone here. This is my name is Alvin Ang with the theater program, and we're honored today to do this in collaboration with the Center for Ethnic Studies, with the BMCC Theater Club, and also with CUNY's Asian American Asian Research Institute. So they're all in the house. Let's give them some applause. All over all of you. And we're honored today that we'll have members from the Thomas Tan family. And many things are coming together. As in many ways, it's also a celebration of the legacy of the great late Dr. Thomas Tan. He's one of the founding members of CUNY's ARI and also of Asian Cinevision. And they've supported so many groups. And this year, many things came together. They have an annual Thomas Tan scholarship. And this year, the recipient of that scholarship is a theater directing student. So I was very happy about that. And we're so happy to be able to have he'll be directing our reading today. And today is pretty much in two parts. We'll have a play reading. It's a reading of Trying to Find Chinatown by David Henry Huang. And also, there'll be a town hall discussion about community, identity, and how do we find representation for Asian Americans and all underrepresented voices. So we'll have some special guests, and then we'd love to open it up for everyone to join in. So, and just one little bit of housekeeping. Well, please take a second to silence your phones, please. Thank you. And at the end, we'll have our coffee, tea, and cookies for everyone, too. So we can stay around for that, too. And for individual mingling as well. Okay, so without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to our cast. It's our cast of actresses. It's Justin Saluso.
Trying to Find Chinatown by David Henry Huang. Darkness over the house speakers. Sound fading. Hendrick-like virtuoso rock and roll riffs. Heavy feedback distortion. Bass shifting. Wah-wah amplified over the tiny Fender pop notes. Lights fade up to reveal that the music's being played over the solid body electric violin by Ronnie, a Chinese-American male in his mid-20s. He's dressed in retro 60s clothing and has a few requisite 90s body mutilation. He's playing on the sidewalk for money. His violin case open before him. Change and a few stray bills have been left by previous passers-by. Benjamin enters. He's in his early 20s, blonde, blue-eyed, a Midwestern tourist in the big city. He holds a scrap of paper in his hand, scanning street signs for an address. He pauses before running, listens for a while. With a truly revealing run, Ronnie concludes the number and falls to his knees, gasping. Benjamin applauds.
Good. That was really great. I did it. I mean a fiddle. I mean, I heard them in square dances and all, on country stations, but never. Wow. This must really be New York City.
Benjamin applauds, starts to walk on. Still on his knees, Ronnie clears his throat loudly.
You're not just doing this for your health, right?
Benjamin reaches in his pocket, pulls out a couple of coins. Ronnie clears his throat again.
Look, I'm not a millionaire. I'm just...
Benjamin pulls out his wallet, removes a dollar bill. Ronnie nods his head and gestures towards the violin case as he takes out a pack of cigarettes. Lights one.
Don't call it a fiddle, okay?
Oh, well, I didn't mean
to. You sound like a wuss. A hick. A dipshit.
It just slipped out. I didn't really...
If this was a fiddle, I'd be sitting here with a cob pipe and stomping my cowboy boots and kicking up hay. Then I'd go home and fuck my cousin.
Oh, well? I don't really think...
Do you see a cob pipe? Am I fucking my cousin?
Well, no, not at the moment, but...
All right, then. This is a violin. Now, you give me your money and I ignore the insult. Herein ends the lesson.
Look, a dollar's more than I've ever given to someone asking for money.
Yeah, well, this is New York. Welcome to the cost of living.
What I mean is, maybe in exchange you could help me.
Jesus Christ. Do you see a sign around my neck reading Big Apple fucking Tourist Bureau?
I'm just looking for an address. I don't think it's far from here. Maybe you could...
Benjamin holds out his scrap of paper. Ronnie snatches away.
You're lucky I'm such a goddamn softie.
He looks at the paper.
Fuck you. You suck my dick. You and the cousin you wrote it on.
I don't get it. What are you?
You know exactly what I mean.
I'm just asking for a little...
13 Dollar Street, like you don't know where that is.
Of course I don't know, that's why I'm asking.
Well, come on, you trailer park refugee, you don't know that's Chinatown.
Sure, I know that's Chinatown.
I know you know that's Chinatown.
So that doesn't mean I know where Chinatown.
So why is it that you pick me, of all the street musicians in the city, to point you in the direction of Chinatown? Oh, let me guess. Is it the earring? No, I don't think so. The Hendrix riff? Guess again, you fucking moron.
Now, wait a minute. I see what you're...
What are you going to ask me next? Where you can find the best dim sum in the city? Whether I can direct you to a genuine opium den? Or do I happen to know how you can meet Miss Saigon for a night of nuki-nuki followed by a good old-fashioned ritual suicide? Now get your white ass off my sidewalk. $1 doesn't even begin to make up for all this aggravation. Why don't you go back home and raise bullfrogs or whatever...
Brother! I can absolutely relate to your anger. Righteous rage, I suppose. Would be a more appropriate term to be marginalized as we are by a white racist patriarchy to the point where the accomplishments of our people are obliterated from the history books. This is cultural genocide of the first order, leading to the fact that you must be battled with all of your America's emasculating the brutal stereotypes of Asians, the opium den, the sexual objectification of the Asian female, the exoticized image of a tourist Chinatown, which ignores the exploitations of workers, failure to unionize, the high rate of mental illness and tuberculosis. Against these, each day you rage, no, not as a victim, but as a survivor. Yes, brother, a glorious warrior survivor.
Hey, what?
So I hope that you can see that my request
is not motivated
by the sorts of racism.
But wait, how did you learn all that?
Oh, what?
Oppression stuff, tuberculosis.
It's statistically irrefutable. TB occurs in the community.
Where did you learn it?
I took Asian American Studies in college.
Where did you go to college?
University of Wisconsin, Madison.
Madison? Like, Wisconsin?
That's not where the bridges are, by the way.
Oh, all right.
You wouldn't believe the number of people.
So they have Asian American Studies in Madison, Wisconsin. Since when?
Since the last Third World Unity hunger strike. Why do you look so surprised? We're down.
I don't know. It just never occurred to me the idea of Asian students in the Midwest going on a hunger strike.
Well, a lot of them had midterms that week. So they fasted in shifts. The administration never figured it out. The Asian students put that they all look alike stereotype to good use.
Okay. So they got Asian American studies, but that still doesn't explain
what.
What you were doing taking it?
Just like everyone else, I wanted to explore my roots, and you know, the history of oppression, which is my legacy. After a lifetime of assimilation, I wanted to find out who I really am.
Did you?
Sure. I learned to take pride in my ancestors who built the railroads. My papa, who would make me a hot bulb joke with thousand-day-old AIDS when the white kids chased me home yelling, cook, chink, slant.
Okay, that's enough.
Painful to listen to.
I don't know what kind of bullshit ethnic studies program they're running over in Wisconsin, but did they bother to teach you that in order to find your Asian roots, it's a good idea to first be Asian?
You're speaking metaphorically?
No, literally. You look at your skin.
You know, it's very stereotypical to think that all Asian skin tones conform to a single hue.
You're white. Is this some kind of redneck joke or something? Am I the first person in the world to tell you this?
Oh, I
know real Asians are scarce in the Midwest, but Jesus.
No, of course. I see where your misunderstanding arises.
Yeah, it's called you white.
It's just that in my hometown of Tribute, Kansas, and then at school, see, everyone knows me. So this sort of thing never comes up. Benjamin Wong. I forget that a society where its racial constructs constantly forces me to explain my very existence.
Ronnie Chang, otherwise known as the Bowman.
You see, I was adopted by Chinese-American parents at birth, so clearly I'm Asian-American.
Even though you're blonde and blue-eyed.
You can't just judge my genetic heritage alone by race.
Well, if the genes don't determine race, what does?
Perhaps that you prefer that I continue in denial, masquerading as a white man.
You can't just wake up and say, gee, I feel black today.
Brother, I'm just trying to find what you've already got.
What do I got?
A home. With your people. Picketing with the laundry workers. Taking refuge from daily slights against your masculinity and the noble image of Guan Gong.
Guan who?
Come on. The Chinese god of warriors? Who do you take me for? There are altars to him all over the community.
I don't know what community you're talking about, but it's sure as hell not mine.
What do you mean?
I mean, if you want to call Chinatown your community, okay, knock yourself out, learn to use chopsticks, big deal. Go ahead. Try and find your roots in some dim sum parlor with headless ducks hanging in the window. Those places don't tell you a thing about who I am.
Oh, I get it.
You get what?
You're one of those self-hating, assimilated Chinese Americans, aren't you?
Jeez.
You probably call yourself Oriental, huh? Look, maybe I can help you. I have some books like
I have read all those Asian identity books when you were still slathering on industrial strength sunblock. Sure, I'm Chinese, but folks like you act like that means something. Like all of a sudden you know who I am. You think identity's that simple? That you can wrap it all up in a neat package and say, I have ethnicity, therefore I am? All you fucking ethnic fundamentalists, always settling for easy answers. You say you're looking for identity, but you can't begin to face the real mysteries of the search. So instead, you go skin deep and call it a day.
Oh. So what...
He turns away from Benjamin and starts to play his violin, slow and bluesy.
So what are you? Just a human being? That's like saying you have no identity. If you asked me to describe my dog, I would say he's more than just a dog.
What, you think that if I deny the importance of my race, I'm nobody? There are worlds out there, worlds that you haven't even begun to understand. Open your eyes, hear with your ears.
Ronnie holds his violin at chest level, but does not attempt to play during the following monologue. As he speaks, rock and jazz violin tracks fade in and out over the house speakers, bringing to life the styles of music he describes.
I concede. It was called a fiddle long ago, but that was even before the birth of jazz, when the hollering in the fields, the rank injustice of human bondage, struggle of God's children against the plagues of the devil's white man. And all these boiled up into that bittersweet brew called by the later generations the blues. That's when fiddlers like Sun Sims held their chin rest at their chest and sawed away like the hillbillies still do today. With the coming of the ragtime appeared the pioneer Duff Smith, who sang as he stroked the catgut with his raspy Louis Armstrong voice, rough and sweet like the timber of a horse hair riding south below the fingerboard, and who finally sailed for Europe to find ears that would hear. Europe, where Stefan Grappelli initiated a magical French violin to be passed from generation to generation. Berti to Jean-Luc Ponty, then Ponty to Didier Lockwood. Listen to Grappelli play a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square is to understand not only the song of birds, but how they learn to fly, fall in love on the wing, and finally falter one day to wait for darkness beneath the London street lamp. And Ponty, he showed how the modern violin man can accompany the shadow of his own lead lines, which cascade one over another into some netherworld beyond the range of human hearing. Giovannuti, Noel Pointer, Sven Asmussen, and even the Kronos Quartet with their arrangement of Purple Haze. Now tell me, could any legacy be more rich, more crowded with mythology and heroes to inspire pride? What can I say if the banging of the gong?
When I finally found Doyer Street.
Or the clinking of a pickaxe on the transcontinental railroad fails to move me, even as one note played through a violin MIDI controller by Mikhail Urbaniak.
I finally found Doya Street.
Does it have to sound like Chinese opera before people like you decide I know who I am?
When I finally found Doya Street, I scanned the buildings from number 13. Walking down an alley where the scent of freshly stained char siu bao lingered in the air, I felt immediately that I had entered a world where all things were finally familiar. An old woman bumped into me with her shopping bag, screaming to her friend in Cantonese, though they walked no more than a few inches apart. Another man shouting to a vendor in Zia, a youth in white undershirt, perhaps a recent newcomer, bargaining with a grocer in Hoiken. I walked through this ocean of dialects, breathing in the richness with deep gulps, exhilarated by the energy the symphony brought to my step. And when I finally saw the number 13, I nearly wept at my good fortune. No tenement, paint peeling, inside walls no doubt thick with a century of grease and broken dreams. And yet to me, a temple, where my father was born. I suddenly saw it all. Gung Gung coming home from his 16-hour days, pressing shirts he could never afford, own, bringing with him candies from my father, each sweet wrapped in a hope for a better life. My father left the ghetto. He swore he would never come back. But the day he had, in his thoughts and dreams and memories of his son, just 6 months after his death. And as I sat on the stoop, I pulled a wamoy from my pocket, sucked on it, felt his spirit returning to this place, where his ghost, dutiful heart of all his descendants would always call home. Felt an ache in my heart for all those lost souls denied this most important of revelations, to know who they truly are.
Benjamin sucks his salty plum and listens to the sounds around him. Ronnie continues to play. The two remain oblivious of one another. Lights fade slowly to black. End of play.
Some special guests for our panels too. Dr. Linda Varghese from our Asian American Studies program, and Sherry Chen, who's the honorable mention for this year's 2018 Thomas Tan Scholarship. Thank you. Let's start by just having fun about today. We'll be talking about, I guess, theater and community in many different ways, and also. We'd like to have each cast member and each panelist just introduce themselves, talk about how you came to theater and what community means to you, and then we'll open up for a little wide discussion, and then we'll talk about how it relates to play and then relates to all the communities too. So we'd like to, I guess we'll start on this side too, we'll start with Yin and Yi, and Yi is the first
speaker. Oh, okay. Hi, good afternoon. Yes. So, theater. I found it interesting when I just came here about 7 years ago. It's like, wow, finally, somebody gonna listen to me. Like, even though in the beginning, it's just like a couple lines, like not a big role, but yeah, somebody listened to me. And then from acting to directing and got a scholarship from the Thomas Tan family and wow, actually people paying me to do theater. So yeah, that's how I came to theater.
Well, I started theater in college because all my classes, they got canceled due to lack of funding. And the only classes available were theater classes. And I took the theater classes and I just fell in love and said, yeah, I can do this for the rest of my life.
Same thing as Lucius, like, I would always take classes in my beginning years of college just to fulfill the gen ed requirements. And I'm like, these classes are really hard. I need one class in my schedule that I can enjoy. So I would take acting one, then I took musical theater, then I took modern dance. And I'm like, not all my classes have to be mundane. I can enjoy the world of theater and have that be my major.
Hi everyone, my name is Sherry, currently a sophomore at Baruch College, so I don't attend BMCC. Basically, from my experience, I'm currently a marketing major and minoring in graphic design and New York City studies, so very different from like theater majors. I can tell a little bit about like how I got into like the Asian American community and maybe just a little bit of theater. So throughout high school, I participated in a program called the Youth Community Project Team. So basically, we're advocates against domestic violence and sexual assault, and we're catered to the Korean American community. But I was Chinese, so when I first joined the program, I was the first Chinese to join, and everyone thought I was Korean at that time. And so it was really funny in how I kind of pretended to be Korean. They were speaking with me in Korean, and I just went with the flow. But then later on, actually, they realized that, I'm Chinese. And it was funny because I participated in that program for 4 years and ended up getting more diverse. So even non-Asian people started joining. So that's how that kind of ended to be. And when I was in the program, we call it YCPT. So basically in that program, we were also doing play productions. So every year, for the past 3 years until the last year, we were doing play productions. So basically about women, in the society, about teen violence, domestic violence, or even rape issues. So my senior year, I was directed a play and wrote a script for Emma. So basically it was this high school senior, she was raped on prom night, and she talked about her struggle, her upbringing, how she was interacting with her kind of parents, and how the school community kind of interacted with her. We were basing it on a lot of statistics and stories and research that we've done before. So that's a little bit how I got into Asian community and also theater. That's a long spiel.
I enjoy theater. And you guys did such a great job. I didn't know that BMCC had this. It's so impressive.
Some CCNY students it's a CCNY BMCC collaboration.
Yeah.
It's a CUNY
yeah.
thing.
So I am much older than the rest of the panelists, but
she was including me in that.
as I was listening to the play, I read it earlier, how did it come into Asian American Studies? I feel like it's, if you ask me now, it's very different than what I would have said 10, 15 years ago. And I think that speaks to the changing of the community and the changing of the discipline. I was reminded when I was watching the play, one memory that popped up in my mind was that when I was in college, and I am from Texas, right? People don't usually think of Asians in Texas. There's a very large community. I wanted to get a tattoo of a Hindu goddess. And I was because this will show that I claim my community. And now I'm oh my God, if I had done that, my idea of community and identity and self has changed so much. I would have had to save up money to get that move. And so it's interesting to me to read this play, to hear it performed when it was about 20 years ago, that it's written. But it's still relevant because it's asking questions about identity and inheritance and who we are and how all that stuff comes into being. But I was really, I did have the image of the tattoo I wanted to get, kind of visiting how I would feel about that. Then I went and got a doctorate in anthropology. I am an academic. For an identity, what I actually research on is gender and labor, and then also kind of Asians and me, the economics as a cultural form. So very different than what I thought about when I first got into Asian American studies.
And we're going to talk about the play pulls together many different strands, and also we'll be hearing from them in a little bit. We're going to have members of Tom Tam's family here today too, so we're happy to have that. And in many ways, I've done a lot of volunteer work over the years with the Asian American Asian Research Institute, and the Tom Tam Scholarship is something that's been created in memory of Thomas Tam to support students. It's always gone to more arts, more math and science students. And so it's that generality remains true sometimes. This year, we were at that gala, and I was thrilled to say, oh my God, this year they're honoring two theater students. So I was very happy about that. And I said, it would be great to have a conference like that. And then luckily, Carl Williams, who runs the theater program here, invited me to produce this a program in honor of Asian Heritage Month. And I said, and the document line said, it would be great. Well, it's a play from my generation. We'll do Imagine if students today wanted to do trying to find Chinatown. It's a David Henry Hwang play from way back from the 20th century, from 1996. Yeah. And I met with Yi, and we talked about the concept of what we want to do, and the first play he mentioned was Trying to Find Chinatown. So I'd be curious how it still speaks to us today, and also what everyone does. You feel like using Chinatown is almost like a metaphor, just a touch point of what constitutes a Chinese-American community or any community. Does that still resonate today as it did in the play? Just curious about your reactions to that. Some of the panels in the open.
Yeah, I mean, there were some resonances for sure. I think that space plays a large role in identity formation, and so, but as is family, right? And so I think I did not grow up, I grew up in Texas. We didn't have like a concentrated South Asian or Indian area, but there were so many institutions, religious, community organizations. Like, I had to go to dance school for 10 years of my life, and my parents forced me to, right? And so we got that kind of spatial places, like spatiality of identity formation. Sorry to sound like an academic, that's what I am. right, but then I also think about like how much just being in a family shapes our identity. I think those resonances are definitely there. I do think though that there was something so masculinist about the play that when I first read it, I was just like, oh, okay, all right, dude. Then I was like, oh, actually, if I can just drop this one point, like starting in the 80s, there was kind of an increase in female migration just across the board, but also from Asia. And so I did wonder like how that has shaped identity and community and how we think of Asian American, not just as like these men who come and their families join later, but as, you know, kind of a gendered and also like kind of like other identities that start to influence who we are as Asian Americans that didn't always come through in plays like this.
Speak to you now, she infiltrated that Korean society too.
So I was born and raised here, so I think growing up, my parents always wanted me to be like this straight A student, and like obviously I go to Peru.
Speak louder, because it's
okay. So I was born and raised here. When I was growing up, my parents they immigrated here from Guangdong, and so when I first came, when they told me, like, they were always telling me, like, oh, you have to get the straight A student, you have to be like follow this traditional career path. I go to Baruch, so it's finance and accounting students. I at first wanted to do like accounting or even finance because I just wanted to like earn more money and like satisfy what my parents wanted. I don't think this kind of like mindset of like kind of this model minority really never really changed, even like with my older cousins. It was always like you have to do well in school, you have to like achieve better. And I guess like it's because I'm first generation, so it adds even more pressure. Like, okay, now you're first generation, you gotta take advantage of what we gave you since you were born in here in America. So I think this hasn't changed much, and there's still a lot of pressure, but it's getting better.
Justin, I'm just curious about how you took to this play, and also if it resonated with any of the communities. I'm sure, you know, we're all made up of many different communities. Any of the communities that you identified with and have spoken with? This reaction to the play, Justin, and then maybe what it sparked you, Justin, with this ideas of community.
I thought it was a great play, and like there's like subtle little lines in the play that really like notified us that we all evolve over time and we become more open-minded. Like when they said they had Asian American studies at Madison, Wisconsin, they didn't always have that. But people, like when people are oppressed and when people need to be heard, they speak and people listen if they speak loud enough. So they were able to get Asian American studies. And with that, people can be more sensitive to different people's cultures. I feel like people are really insensitive when they're ignorant or when they don't know of some of these issues or struggles or culture. So like as time goes on, we are more notified of different walks of life.
That's cool. And do you feel like the way Davis and everyone grappled with these issues in the play in 1996, do you feel that still speaks to you today?
I would actually want to piggyback on two comments before
about
expectations, because when I first started acting, acting class, one of the professor, she wanted to do like a monologue, like introduction to like monologue, take a monologue from a play that's contemporary, and I picked a really terrible monologue, but that's a different story. And she complained, she pulled me aside, and why did you pick this monologue? Is this not for you? And right away she suggested me David Henry Hwang. And part of me wanted to say like, yes, he's a great writer because his writing is great and I love him. But at the same time, what made you think that I would connect to David Henry Hwang? What is expected of me as an Asian artist? Are we expected to sell our identity as if like it's that's what's gonna define me? Like, does my artwork does not matter if it doesn't cater to like I am Asian and therefore I am? I don't know. I don't know. It made me think a lot about what it means of to be expected.
Absolutely. And do you feel like a similar to feel like David grappled with these issues in the play? Do you feel that it still speaks to you here now and in 2019?
Yeah. Because Ronnie, my character, is a very strange character. He looks Asian and he has everything that makes him look Asian. But inside of him, his spirit is very different color. It's very different. And I heard this from he was a psychology major. In order to drive someone crazy, you just have to tell them that what they see is different from what they think they see. And I think that's what we go through. It's traumatic that we see ourselves as something else, but we're just told that we're not. And that still rings today, not just in the Asian American community, but in various different minority groups and underrepresented groups in America, especially.
Yeah, so Chinatown. I guess everybody needs to find their Chinatown. And like growing up, either you're born here or you were born outside of here. It just, New York is like so many countries in New York. And finding your Chinatown or Little Italy and whatever you are looking for. And it's about finding your identities. And, but I would say that identity, once you've found it, it will be the past. And, it's not saying you need to forget it, but if you just hold on to the past, then I don't see where you can live in the future except Chinatown.
All different countries. I think they are going to be. I don't know. I love the different representations here. Like I grew up in Queens and Flushing, and it's thing, the different countries in New York. I think the architect Philip Johnson said that his favorite country is Texas. That's what he said.
We are a country.
Just where we are now as a culture. I think we want faithful, like I guess loving representation, and but also at the same time, I think as artists, no one wants to be told to stay in the lane. Like I'm a playwright, and I was telling some of the younger Queens folks, hey, when I was growing up, we were one of the few Asian families in Flushing, you believe it? And I did a piece about that. I did it for a while. I performed as the last emperor of Flushing. That's my unofficial title. and so we can go. I'll tell you. Yes. And it turned out to too, where another reason too that all a few of our families are from Guangdong, so all these things came out. So it's where we want accurate and faithful representation, but no one wants to be told just stay in your lane. And I think we have some students are here though too. I think some of the things that I think that David was grappling with here in 1996 also resonated in the play, the great play Yellowface that we just studied too. So we go that there too. And more than that, I'd just love to get some people's general reactions to the play and on these issues too. Like, how do we feel that no matter what community or communities you identify with, what platforms are available for these? Communities to express themselves and define themselves, and then maybe the hardest question we've been fighting for forever, how can we have dialogue between these different communities? How can we really talk to each other and start with the Olympics too? And so until that, we want to share some ideas with that. And any questions for the specific panelists as well?
One in the middle, what class is this?
You say your name again, too.
Lucius.
Lucius. Alright. When I first heard your mouth, you remember it was a prior. You know why? Because you're using those language words at you or at you, know. When I.
Richard Pryor.
Yeah,
Richard
Pryor. Like you said,
we're not. He's an American.
Oh, you're a comedian. Oh, you're a comedian.
Am I a comedian?
Yes.
Funny person.
You know why I asked you a question? Because the way he was coming out, talking to him, all that stuff. When I went to reply, he had the type of person like that as a comedian. When I went to the show, I went with my ex-friend, in 1979. In Rockaway, I took her to see Richard Pryor. That's how he came up. And we was cracking up.
Yeah.
And that's how you came out with it, like that. I saw you writing things like that. You wrote that right.
He came even before old school people like Dave Chappelle. He came even before Dave Chappelle and even before Eddie Murphy. I understand that too. But also, I noticed that too. At our first rehearsal, I said that you have these really street rhythms in your body language and some of your cadences too. And so I think you were picking up on that too. So it's very interesting how the language of the streets and how and I think that really spoke to us of it was real New York sensibility, not just of Asian American.
And that's actually a character choice. It's a shield. I want to stay away from looking like a Chinese. Well, not I. Ronnie, the character, wants to stay away from the stereotypes. So he would actually try to embody the New York accent and try to even appropriate the sound that is not even his so that he can get away and deny the identity.
Yeah, great choice. That was a great choice. And to start the late, great Richard Pryor. Yeah.
So just to follow up on what Lucius said, in our society, the real issue is how do we not all assimilate to be one? Going back to the Star Trek thing, why are we all not the Borg? We're fighting to be not the Borg. And that's really the essence of, I think, what's going on here.
And just like, maybe not everyone knew who Richard Pryor was, you might have to tell us who the Borg is. If you don't mind.
The Borg were the characters in Star Trek that be one with the collective. So once you were, the Borg came, they assimilated everybody. And if you weren't assimilated, you were destroyed. Oh. So you had to be one. So our society tries to be like the Borg. We want everybody to be the same. Even though we are Asian. It's like Tiger Woods saying, I'm not black. What do you mean you're not black? Right? It's like me saying, I'm not Asian. Right? It's not, you're missing the obvious. All right. And in our society, that's what we want. We don't want deviation from the norm. We don't want outliers. We don't want people who aren't talking all the same or thinking the same. And this play shows us the problems that we have in our society. Okay. I was telling Sherry, right, that I'm Chinese. I was a Democratic Club president in Manhattan. And to this day, I am the only Asian American Democratic Club president outside of Chinatown. To this day. And I was Democratic Club president 20 years ago. All right. So even though we think we've changed and we've evolved, we haven't.
But you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? I think.
Yeah.
A good thing, a bad thing that I am the only Democratic Club president?
Because I have my own opinion on that.
I think it's a bad thing because you for you to have a presence in our society, to really be part of it, you have to be part of it. Okay? And if politics makes the way our society evolves and works, and you don't want to participate in that, then how could you be part of society?
Well, you know, I agree that you, I think assimilation is important. I think identity politics is very hazardous. It can be very hazardous. And this play, I think, what would you say, it was 1996?
Yes.
It's dated. It really is. David Henry Blanc written. He's actually matured, and his play that he performed in San Francisco, the one that's sort of part opera, play within a play.
And Butterfly?
No. That was really
fresh
that was dated. Really dated.
Fresh off.
Huh?
Fresh off the boat.
Shameless.
That's the one where he talks about when he gets stabbed in Brooklyn.
Oh, that was in 2013.
Oh, that's very new. Don't take new, but that the space in the shoes that David Henry Wong's attack years ago.
Yeah, but he wrote. It was. I saw it out in San Francisco last year, and I think I heard it was coming to New York. But I think that's a much better play. This is really. I think this play is a really dated play. It talks about things that maybe were in the forefront maybe 20 years ago.
Can I just say something, though? I think one of the interesting things about the Asian community, and this is one of the questions that Alvin asked us before, is what does it mean in 2019? And I would agree with you that the play is a little dated, but that's okay, right? It's like, it is kind of an artifact of its time that we can talk about. But one of the things about the Asian American community in the United States in general is that the majority of that community is actually immigrants.
And so
I think that the idea of like what it means to then belong to the United States or even to be Asian, I mean, I've been teaching college level for 20 years, and I feel that there is a way to track the different ways that successive waves of students have actually thought about their Asianness, and part of it is shaped by new groups that come in, and I do think that maybe the Chinatownness of the play is different. I mean, Chinatown now, right? It's like this developer's dream of like such expensive real estate. But there is something I would argue about ideas of like what it means. How do you claim an identity? Right? Is it family? Is it space? Like I think the Ronnie character, I mean, is it by saying, like, look, actually, it's through this, like, global music art form that kind of converges from all these different influences? So I'm not sure if you're saying that it's dated because of its location or dated because of ideas of identity have changed, but I wouldn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the significance of identity is, like, so much different where you live and where you're raised. Because, like, in, like, New York City, like, we're in classes with 17 different races, 17, like, a million different colors. And it doesn't mean that much that you're different from me and you're not different than her, or you are different than her or him. And it's very much a blessing for it to be like that. And go to a different part of, like, the country and people, like, see you as a very negative connotations or... And if people treat you in such a negative light, like, that's what you see. And it's just like unfortunate that not everybody can have the same privilege as we do in a diverse community as New York City.
What I find, this gentleman here, your name, sir?
Yes.
What's your name?
What I heard you say a moment ago, which was very profound to me, is that you cannot live in the past, that you must evolve. And if you don't evolve, you are going to live in the past. And I like that.
Have a good night.
I put some of my students on the spot for a moment. That was here where I think we just studied Yellowface. I think you could probably recognize a lot of the themes here that are there. Would you mind? Can I put you on the spot. Think about how both within David's evolution and arc, and then within your own perceptions of now from 2019.
Yellowface is another play by David Henry Hwang. It's actually about David Henry Hwang's experience writing another play. And basically the plot of the play is that he gets he tries to get an Asian lead, and he kind of, like, a white guy auditions, and he kind of fools himself into thinking that the white guy is Asian. And he himself makes a whole Asian identity for the white man. The white man adopts Marcus, that's the name. And so it basically becomes this huge problem when he realizes that Marcus actually isn't Asian at all. But Marcus takes the identity and runs with it, right? And so it's really interesting comparing that to this play, because in Yellowface, Marcus is practicing Yellowface. He's saying, I'm Asian, and it's all false. But, like, this play is a little different because the character of Benjamin is not really pretending. He does have some Asian heritage, so it's a comparable character, but it's a little different in that sense. So it's like a more sympathetic take on it. So the fact that this comes from the same playwright kind of just shows his, like, well-rounded understanding of identity. There's a case of a white man falsely claiming Asian heritage, and then there's a case of a white man who might have a point with Benjamin. Now, as for me personally, I found this play right here a little interesting, particularly with the character Ronnie, because he is trying to shield himself from his Asian heritage. And so he's throwing that away, but I don't think he really is. I think part of it is just that he might be, like, tired and annoyed of expectation of being Asian, and so he might, what he really wants to do is music. That's his interest, that's his found interest, and that's his found identity. And he wants to just do that, and he just feels the baggage of being Asian on top of that. He doesn't want to be an Asian guy. He wants to be a music guy. I think that's how I see his character, personally, and I can relate to that because, you know, I'm from Kashmir. That's a disputed territory in Asia between Pakistan, India, and China. And as a result, I have a very confused racial identity because there's really nothing I can draw from besides what my parents get, which is from all three of those countries. But at the same time, I feel like Ronnie a little bit, that I don't want that to be who I am, the Kashmiri guy, or the guy who people think is Pakistani or Indian. I want to be who I make myself. I want to be with my interests, my studies, what I want to do, my creativity. I want to go into technology. I want to, like, make programs and stuff. But obviously, because of who I am and how I look like, I'm still gonna feel that racial baggage. So I can relate to Ronnie's struggle in that sense, that I can't be exactly who I want to be because I look a certain way. I'm born with it. And so in that sense, Ronnie's also a bit of a hypocrite, because even though he's trying to make this identity for himself, he sees Benjamin and is like, oh, you're a white man. You're completely white. He's just judging him on his looks, and he doesn't realize that. So, yeah. And I think that David Henry Hwang has a very well-rounded sense of identity in this case.
Thanks for representing BMCC today, too. Yes. From the Asian American Studies program for the last 20 years, have the questions from the students radically changed from that? This guy's such a great developer.
Yes and no. I mean, I think there are some concepts that I think have remained constant, like, Asians always being seen as, like, foreigners. Asians always being seen as foreigners, even if you've been here for generations. I think that's, like, a constant. But I think that because the Asian group in aggregate has diversified so much, right, you get a different set of questions from, I think, from that diversity. So I know that in BNCC, like, one of the groups that often don't get included, really, is kind of Indo-Caribbean folks, right? So it's like they are Asian, they're part of a diaspora, but they don't really, they haven't for a long time fit into a traditional Asian American studies model. And then the other thing I'll say is that just the rise of kind of Asian pop culture globally has really, I mean, I grew up kind of being like, oh my God, like Asian, like Indian culture sucks. But then it's like, at some point, it's like, oh, people know what Bollywood is. And now, like K-pop, like Korean pop culture is so big. So I think that's also kind of started to influence and change some of the questions in Asian American studies, but then also some of the knowledge that students come into the classroom with, too.
I'm not sure assimilation is all it's cracked up to be. I know I was born in New York. I'm an older man, and I've always held people in high esteem who've held on to the culture they were born into. And, you know, for whatever reason, now they find they're in another culture, but many times that culture and that place they're assimilating to is not good. And the thing that makes me cry is that their feelings are so strong, especially in the Chinese community, a kind of religious feeling that's so strong, and it seems to be the backbone. And I think that's what's really kept close-knit Chinese communities. But again, I don't think that assimilation is all that it's cracked up to be.
It's always a big question for everyone. Like, how do we embrace plurality, if you will? Well, how do we have dialogue with each other but still being, you know, say, faithful to who we are? Actually, so we'll throw that out there. There's no easy answer to that. But
I think in response to what you just said about assimilation, I don't think that's really what we were looking for. We're looking for us to grow as a person, as an individual, to embrace other cultures rather than to say, I'm Chinese, I have to understand and believe everything that's Chinese and, you know, eat the roast pork buns and everything else. So the thing is that I need to enjoy other things like spaghetti and meatballs or pizza or something else. The problem with our society, I think, is that I am Chinese, and everybody has to understand I'm Chinese, and this is the way I am, and I'm not going to change. Well, just like the dinosaurs who refused to change, they became extinct. And we don't want to do that. You want to not assimilate, but enjoy the variety that we have before our eyes and what society brings.
I think you had your hand up, right?
I would definitely agree that I think that when coming to this country, my father immigrated to this country from the West Indies when he was 13, but my mom was born here, but her father immigrated. Well, his immigration doesn't really count because he's from Puerto Rico, which is... But anyway, so with those influences constantly in my house, like the idea of even just migrating here to New York, just in general, you are instantly, you know, given this barrage of culture, yes, when you come to New York. But I was received this barrage of culture when I was born, when I started to understand that my parents and family are from all over the place. Like, I've got family from all over the United States, yes, but I have family all over the world as well. And the idea of wanting this, like, Americanness or wanting to assimilate has never been something, I'll say when I was younger, I did not like that I was this dark color. I didn't want to be white. I did not want to be black. I wanted to be something in between. And the wanting that and being able to like sit and understand that that's something that I wanted at one point. Yes, it does make me cry because, you know, now I wouldn't give this up for the world. I wouldn't want to change. I wouldn't want to wake up anyone else. But that did not come from refusing to assimilate to this, you know, idealistic Americanness. It came from fully accepting all that I am, that Mariah is, like, and, you know, embracing that, not just with all the cultures that influence who I am, but all of the, you know, the talents that I have, all of the skills that I've acquired over the years, my education, my, you know, just everything about me, my spirituality, all of those things are, you know, so crucial to what makes me who I am. But I had to, and yes, with counseling and talking to other people of color, talking to other people throughout the entire diaspora, you know, because I also consider myself an African descendant. Throughout all of those conversations, having to have those conversations helped me to build the foundation in order to establish, okay, well, what else is Mariah? Like, I'm not just, you know, the daughter of immigrants. I'm not just the daughter of bootleggers. I'm not just the, you know, this child, this kid from Yonkers. There's so much more about me, and I was able to appreciate those things. And, you know, when people would come up to me like, oh, so like you're black, so you like X, Y, Z. Are you, you know, like I don't even have to correct them. You know, like, yeah, I like all those black things, and I also like all the Hispanic things and the, you know, the Indian things and so on and so forth. All those things that make up who I am that you can't see just from looking at me. And for me, yes, it's like a little secret I have, like a little, a special thing about me that, like, you only get to know if you get close. So for those people who refuse to get close to each other and refuse to allow themselves to see themselves in another person, not just because they look like you. It's much easier to see yourself in someone that looks like you than to find your own, like, to encounter yourself inside of someone that doesn't look anything like you. I think those encounters are more important than any sort of assimilation, any trying to be like, you know, the white man or what have you, that has occurred in any, you know, immigration story in this country. That's more important.
What happened?
Hi. By the way, I'm here representing the BMCC Theater Club. I just wanted to say, I think one thing that's great about theater, and theater within CUNY in particular, is you have this melting pot of all these different cultures that without those opportunities, like this reading today, a lot of people wouldn't have a window into other people's experiences. And I just wanted to express my gratitude for that, and just looking forward to continuing to see other people's perspectives that you otherwise might not, and theater can spark these conversations that otherwise wouldn't happen without theater and the arts in general. And that, I just think that's a beautiful thing, and, you know, resonating with people that you might not expect.
Thank you for that. We'll take some time to have some individual things too, because I see in one of my the sounds you heard was the arrival of coffee and things. So just one quick note: David Henry Wong, if nothing else, he always has a great sense of humor. Does anyone know what is that 13 Doyers Street?
13 no Doyers Street.
Yes,
that's old Chinatown.
But you know what it is?
It's
the Nam Wa Tea Parlor, first dim sum restaurant ever. So
it's still there.
You can't say David does not have a sense of humor. So I just love that.
And it's still there.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to tell a little story. When you said you were the only
Democratic president,
to some other comments too. It's kind of funny. My wife, who happens to be Chinese from Guangdong, and I went to Boston last week. And maybe some of you have heard of the Asian guy who's running for president, Andrew Yang. Mm-hmm. We went to his rally in Boston, and our friend met us in Boston. He's originally from Guangdong also, but been here a long time. And so he has a whole
very good feel for what it's like to live in the United States. And so we're at this rally, okay, and there's about 1,000 people there on the Boston Common. And he said, God, I'm really surprised there's so many white people here.
Andrew Yang said that?
I know. My friend, who's from our friend.
Okay, sorry. I'm sorry.
Andrew Yang. He's surprised. But anyway, he said, as a Chinese, looking at Andrew Yang running for president, I'm so surprised there's so many. This is the way it really happened. I'm surprised there's so many Chinese here. I mean, white people here. And I said, got me mixed up there. I said, well, I'm really surprised there's so many Chinese here because I wasn't used to Chinese living with my wife and their apoliticalness and the fact that they're not, you don't see many Chinese in politics. So it was two opposite comments that just came out.
Because race is such a key element of the story, may we ask the identity of the person who said, I'm surprised there's so many white people here?
A Chinese man who's been living here said, I'm surprised to see so many white people here. And I said, I'm surprised that so many Chinese are here. So, you know, it was just so funny because I know why I thought what I did, and I think I know why he said, I'm surprised to see so many white people here.
Absolutely.
You can imagine why he would say that. So,
I'm going to close off the formal part of the discussion. Again, please stay for we have coffee, tea, cookies, but also if there's one common thread through all these different threads, it's we're here in many ways also to celebrate the legacy of the late Dr. Thomas Tam and all that Dr. Tam has established for Asian American education and arts, and we're honored to have two members of his family here. So we want to just share something with us. Please welcome Pearl and Hyung Tam.
Hi, how are you? I'm the younger brother. I'm the youngest one. So I'm the one that is spoiled, overloved, and overprotected. Gee, that's a nice feeling. Pearl is here. So she's my sister. Theater, film, is a great way to communicate. And that's one of the love of Tom. True love. He's always torn between the art of film, in which a lot of his film was exhibited through Museum of Modern Art and things like that. He was accepted to NYU Film School twice, and he, because of community call, he rejected it and went back to the community. So theater is really an older form of film. But you know, what makes him a little different than someone like me is he aspired for leadership. He aspired for people to think ahead. For example, when the September 11 happens, the city and the state find it expedient to get us make two circles. The first circle, we compensate so much. The second circle, we compensate so much. And that's it. We're being fair. And he preempt that by bringing a lot of scientists with him during that public forum and explaining that the wind pattern of that day was somewhat different. And due to the heat and all of the other element that happens, the majority of the carcinogen that flowed through the air that was at certain degrees of moisture and able to carry it all the way up to 14th Street. And that is why Chinatown, along all the way to 14th Street, was allotted compensation, and a lot of the building owner who wanted brand new windows, state-of-the-art windows, were basically allotted certain money to replace it. And for the family that wanted it, to have air conditioning because of the filtering of the air, I was allotted, granted those equipment. So preempting is one of his leadership character. Yeah. And a lot of times he tried to teach me not to judge someone. And then I remember, you know, I grew up on Windsor Terrace. Now they call it Park Slope, but it's really Windsor Terrace. Windsor Terrace, you have to understand the class of Park Slope and Windsor Terrace. That's a totally different story. There's this Irishman who lived a few doors down from me. He and I got into an argument. He said, "Tam, why are you mad at me for calling you a Chinaman?" I said, "That's what I was taught." He said, "No, man. There is a thing called Irish man, English man, China man. I don't mean any." So sometimes we are predestined for certain perception of what people say. So preparing to be leaders, you have to understand that. Just like in L.A. I went to L.A. and I purposely went to Chinatown. The tallest building they have there is three-story high. There's like four of them. And I went and asked them, why? I said, two blocks down, there's 50-story high building. Three blocks down this way, there's 30-some-story high building. Why? He said, "Well, a long time ago, my great-great-grandfather, we all signed this piece of paper. Because the white man told us, there's an earthquake here. And we love you people. We don't want you to have an earthquake." Now, in the leadership of those days, they look around, all of the buildings are one or two-story high. And they have a three-story high buildings. We're the highest among them all. It's okay to sign this. And so they signed it. And so the whole place are being zoned as a possibility of an earthquake, not knowing that there are different technology that develop in the future that allow you, even in earthquake zone, to build 50-story high. Why is that important? It denies you to make 50 times the amount of money for the same investment. That's what happened. So leadership must have foresight. Leadership must have understanding. And leadership must have preempt. And that's some of the character that Tom have, and I wish you all begin to develop.
My brother always taught, before he passed away, he said, everything is consciousness. Everything is consciousness, how you perceive things. And when you perceive things, it has to do with your belief system. What you were taught, where you were, how you were reared up, everything. So whatever system you believe, whatever besides medicine school, avenue, all the things that they drum into us as into our consciousness as being us, yet we have to examine them. So I'm very happy that the play and we have such lively conversation, but it all has to do with what you believe in, how you were taught as a child, and how you were reared up as a child. Because all these traditions, music, all this culture, they you inherited, you assimilated in yourself. And everyone is different. So in order for us to live, we have to get out of ourselves to to try to understand the other person. That's what we
do. Let's thank our panelists again. This is Pearl Tam, Hyung Tam.